Our text for this morning is Psalm 70. There are a few things we want to say about the structure and grammar and heading of this psalm before we get into the actual exegesis of the psalm. Congregation of our Lord. First of all, notice in the heading that David says that this is a psalm to bring to remembrance. We find a similar heading in Psalm 38, a psalm of David to bring to remembrance. The question, of course, is what is that bringing to remembrance that he talks about? I think the best answer to that question is that this is a psalm designed to bring something to the remembrance of God. If you look at Psalm 38, you will see that there David is bringing to God his need for forgiveness. So that's the idea, I think, of Psalm 38, the heading of Psalm 38, that David is bringing to God his need that God remember, his desire that God remember his need for forgiveness. And if you look at this psalm, then I think you can say the same thing. He brings to God his desire that he remember his need, in this case, for deliverance from his enemies. A second thing that we should notice about this psalm is that it's very close in its language to the last verses of Psalm 40. Verses 13 to 17 of Psalm 40 are almost exactly the same as this psalm. Not exactly, but very close anyway. So either this psalm David recognized as verses from Psalm 40 that could be stand alone as their own psalm, or this psalm was incorporated into Psalm 40 as fitting well with the theme of Psalm 40. We do not know which came first. But the Holy Spirit guided him to use these words twice in the songs that he created for God's people. The third thing that we want to notice about this psalm is that it's a chiasm. We're going to talk just briefly about that chiasm. You see that verses 1 and 5 correspond in this chiasm. In verse 1, David makes the petition, make haste, and he repeats that petition in verse 5 in the second line, make haste to me, O God. Notice also that he uses the names of God twice, O God and O Lord in verse 1, and uses those same two names in verse 5. So these are the beginning and ending elements of that chiasm. Then in verses 2 and 4, we have corresponding elements, and we see that especially in the use of the word seek. In verse 2, let them be ashamed and confounded who seek my life. And in verse 4, let all those who seek you rejoice and be glad in you. They are contrasting elements, however. On the one hand, he's praying against his enemies and those who seek his life, and on the other hand, he's praying for those who seek God and his glory. Verse 3 then stands at the heart of the chiasm, and verse 3, if you look at it closely, you'll notice, relates both to verse 2 and to verse 4. Verse 2 is a double parallelism of prayer against his enemies, and verse 3 extends that parallelism to a triple parallelism. So he says, let them be ashamed and confounded, let them be turned back and confused, let them be turned back because of their shame, verse 3. But notice that it also relates closely to verse 4 in that he speaks in verse 3 of those who say, aha, aha, and in verse 4 of those who say continually, let God be magnified. So there's a very carefully constructed chiasm here in Psalm 70. A few other features as well of the psalm. First of all, notice that in verses 1 and 5, the sentences are very short and urgent. Make haste, O God, to deliver me. In fact, it's even shorter and more urgent than that in the Hebrew. And notice that the words make haste at the beginning of verse 1 are in italics, so that we could translate this verse, O God, to deliver me, O Lord, to help me, make haste. And you have the same feature of short sentences in verse 5, but I am poor and needy, Make haste to me, O God. You are my help and my deliverer. O Lord, do not delay. But in contrast with that, and rather unusually for the poetry of the Old Testament and the demands of parallelism, the sentences of verses 2, 3, and 4 are long. So you have these very short and urgent sentences in verses 1 and 5, and then you have these long sentences of petition for his enemies and for the righteous in verses 2, 3, and 4. Let them be ashamed and confounded who seek my life. Let them be turned back and confused who desire my hurt, and so on. Again, another slight difference between verses 1 and 5 and verses 2 to 4. Verses 1 and 5 use the imperative, make haste to help me, O God. And again in verse 5, make haste, do not delay. But verses 2 to 4, instead of using the imperative, there's still petitions in verses 2 to 4, but instead of using the imperative, use what we call the optative. These are expressed as wishes or desires. Let them be ashamed and confounded who seek my life. Let them be turned back and confused who desire my hurt. It's also characteristic of these three verses, 2 to 4, that the subjects of these sentences, of all five of these sentences in these three verses, are at the end of the sentence. We don't usually do this in English, but verses 2 and 3 do show us that. Let them be ashamed and confounded who seek my life. Let them be turned back and confused who desire my hurt. Let them be turned back because of their shame who say, aha, aha. But this is also true in verse 4, that though our translation does not translate in that way. Let those rejoice and be glad in you who seek you. Let those say continually, let God be magnified who love your salvation. The subjects all come then at the ends of the sentences. They're parallel not only in idea, therefore, but in the structure of the sentences. And then finally, notice that in verse 1, we have only two lines, but in its parallel member, in verse 5, we have four lines. We have two lines of petition in verse 5, make haste to me, O God, O Lord, do not delay, and two lines that are statements of fact. But I am poor and needy, you are my help and my deliverer. Let's look at the psalm then under the theme, make haste, O God, or better even, O God, make haste. Let's look first at the first request to make haste in verse 1, then at additional requests in verses 2 to 4, and finally at the second request to make haste in verse 5. When the psalmists and the people of God in the Old Testament addressed God, as David does here in this psalm, by the name God or Elohim, they were thinking of him, of course, as the Mighty One. That word seems to be related to one of the words for might or strength, but also as the unique God. That is, the one who is the only true, the only real, and the only living God. In their context, and it should be the same in our context, of course, they did not think of the gods of the nations as living and real gods. To them, those gods of the nations around them were gods of wood and stone and silver and gold. They had mouths but could not speak. They have had hands but could not handle, and so on. These were dead gods, and it was futile, therefore, to call upon these gods. But when they called on their own God, they thought of him as a living God, a real God, the one true God out of all the gods of the nations. And therefore, they considered, too, that it was not futile to call upon this God, that it was a worthwhile exercise, that this God was a God who could hear, that this God was a God who could answer them, that this God was a God who could, in fact, speak to them his word, and who could bring to them his help by his mighty acts. When they addressed him as Lord, as Yahweh, that is, here in this psalm anyway, then the first thing, of course, about that name is that it speaks of the eternity, the unchangeability, and the self-sufficiency of God. He is the one who is from the beginning, who was from the beginning, who is now, and whoever shall be. He is the one who is eternally unchangeable through all the multiple years of his existence. And he is the one who has no need of any of his creatures. He has all that he needs for his own well-being and his own happiness and his own existence within himself. There is no need for him to create, and there is no need for him at all to be dependent on his creatures that he has made. But they thought of him also, when they called him Yahweh, as their own God again. That was his personal name. And he had given them that name so that in addressing him, they could call him by his own personal name. He drew near to them. That was not only a name that spoke then of his majesty, his eternity, his unchangeability, and so on, but was also a name that spoke to them of his nearness, of his coming to them in covenant. He said to Moses when he sent him into Egypt, "Tell them, I am that I am has sent you unto them." So in these names then, David reminds himself of the fact that God is real and living, and he reminds himself of the majesty of God, and he reminds himself also of God's nearness, of God's covenant with him and with his people. The petitions of this first verse are very general. He asks for help and for deliverance, but he does not ask to specify what deliverance he needs, that is, from what he needs God to deliver him, not at this point anyway. He does not ask him in what way for the specific help that he needs at this time. He throws all the energy of this first petition into that word, make haste. O God, to deliver me. O Lord, to help me, make haste. That's the key note of that first petition. Make haste. His situation is desperate. He is in such desperate need of help that he feels, in fact, that if God does not help him soon or even immediately, he will perish. He is not just seeking but asking. He is not just asking but knocking. We might even say he is not just knocking, but he is pounding frantically at the door as one to whom, if that door will not open, danger and peril will overwhelm him. These words, make haste, are words that teach us, people of God, that we should not be timid in our prayers. This is a very bold, to us anyway, I think a very bold, a very insistent kind of prayer. Make haste. It is as if the psalmist thinks that God is dawdling in coming to his help. He's not moving quickly enough. And he says to God, hurry up! I need your help now! Come! Come to me! But that's not, people of God, impudence. That is a reliance on those great and precious promises that God has spoken. And God encourages us to be bold, to be persistent, and to be insistent in our prayers to him when we are relying on his promises. Let's look now at those additional requests that we find in verses 2 to 4. In verses 2 to 3, David prays against his enemies, and in verse 4, he prays for the righteous. We have here, I think, in verses 2 and 3, a progressive description of these enemies. They are first those who seek his life, they are secondly those who desire his hurt, and they are thirdly those who say, aha, aha. Yeah, first then those who seek his life. The actual Hebrew word there is soul. Those who seek my soul. And I think we should translate it that way. It's becoming more common in our own day, people of God, to translate that word soul as life or something similar to that. And I do not think that's a good trend in our own times. That word in the Hebrew should be translated as much as possible as life, or as soul, not as life. Let's look at just a couple of passages to illustrate the idea that this word does indeed mean the contain in it the idea of soul, even the idea of soul as we think of soul today. You find that, first of all, you find one place in Psalm 34, verse 6, I believe it is. Psalm 34, verse 6. No, I'm sorry, got the wrong verse again. That's a later reference. But anyway, when Abraham was asking the sons of Heth, I don't have the reference here, but when Abraham was asking the sons of Heth to give him the cave of Machpelah, or to sell him the cave of Machpelah for a burying place, he said to them, in our translation, "If it is your wish, speak to Ephron the Hittite that he may sell me this cave." That word wish there, in those words of Abraham, is the word soul. If it is your soul, speak to Ephron. Now, it's very clear, of course, in that context, that that word simply can't mean life. If it is your life, makes no sense there at all. But the word soul can make sense if we take it as referring to the will. And this is what we talk about when we talk about soul, right? The will, the power of the will, the power of the mind, the power of emotion. Again, in another verse in Genesis, we read that the soul of the son of Shechem clung to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob. The soul clung. Again, life makes no sense. And we read in Isaac's desire to bless Esau that he says to Esau, "Go out and fetch me food and give me something savory to eat so that my soul may bless you before I die." Clearly in those passages and in many others that we could point out, people of God, that word soul is the proper idea there. It's not just life. And I think we should understand it that way here also in Psalm 70 and in many other places in the Psalms. It's not just his physical life. The problem with translating it as life here is that it gives the impression that David is primarily concerned about the threat to his physical life. And of course, his enemies are threatening his physical life and his physical well-being. That's undeniable. But David's not primarily concerned about that. They are seeking his soul. And what this means to him is that these attacks on him are a threat to his relationship with God, that these attacks represent temptations, and that they are temptations that will, if they are effective, draw him away from God and ultimately destroy not just his physical life, but destroy his spiritual life. These enemies desire his soul, not just his body, and he wants God to come to the defense of his soul. These enemies, then, to move on to the second description of them, are those who desire his hurt. They seek his soul, but they do not seek his soul for good. They seek his whole soul in order to do injury to him. And finally, in verse 3, they are those who say, "Aha, aha." That is, they are those who gloat and who rejoice if they are successful against him. So you see this progression. They're seeking his soul. They are seeking his soul not for good, but for hurt. And if they should succeed in their purposes, They are those who will say, "Aha, aha." They gloat and triumph over him. He makes then various petitions against these people. He makes petitions against them, first of all, in the matter of shame. Let them be ashamed and confounded. Let them be confused. Let them be turned back because of their shame. That word shame in verse 3 is from the same root as the verb, the first verb in verse 2, let them be ashamed. But that word shame there in verse 3 clearly designates their acts against him, what they are doing. And that those acts are described as shame, of course, because they are shameful acts in themselves, inherently disgraceful things that they want to do to him. And it's because of the inherent shame of those acts, then, that he makes these prayers, let them be ashamed and confounded and confused. Three different Hebrew words which are closely associated and which are found in other contexts as well, in close connection with each other. It's difficult, in fact, to distinguish between those three different words. But I think we may say that there is contained in those three words together these three ideas. First, there is the idea of shame. He wants them to be ashamed of what they have done or what they are trying to do. He wants them to be overwhelmed. They are not now, but he wants them to be overwhelmed with this sense that they have done a very shameful, a very embarrassing thing. This is the internal aspect of the shame then. There's also contained in those words the idea of public disgrace. That is, he doesn't want them just to feel inward shame and embarrassment, but he wants them to be publicly disgraced. He wants their shame to be known to others, to increase that sense of shame and embarrassment which is in them. And finally, there is in those three words also this idea, which we often miss, I think, that he wants them to be disappointed in their expectations. If you look up the uses of those words throughout the Psalms and throughout the Old Testament, you'll see that this disappointment of expectations is also part of it. They come against him, and he's saying, let them be disappointed in what they are planning and what they want to do to me. Frustrate their hopes and turn them back. He uses actually, our translation has turned back twice, but he uses actually two different words. And in the first use of the word, he adds an adverb to it, which our translation doesn't even have. Let them be turned back backward and confused who desire my hurt. Let them be turned away because of their shame, who say, aha, aha. So he's asking God to frustrate their desires, to bring shame and public disgrace upon them because of it, and to turn them away from him so that they can no longer trouble him. Now notice that those petitions against his enemies, who have made his circumstances so desperate that he cries in this very passionate way in verses 1 and 5, are very limited in scope. He does not ask for God to injure them. He does not ask for God to destroy them. He asks only that God put them to shame and turn them back. That's a prayer that we can make. Prayer against our enemies, that should not trouble us. It may, in fact, very well be for the good of our enemies that God do exactly this to them so that they may come to repentance. In verse 4, then, he prays for the righteous. Again, he gives them names. He calls them those who seek you and those who love your salvation. That these are people, then, who do not seek souls to destroy them or to injure them and to gloat over them, but these are people who seek God. They're very different in character from David's enemies. But they are also, in one way, like David, they are people who are in need. They seek God because of a need that they have. In the second place, these are people who love his salvation. They are not people, then, who gloat and who say, aha, aha, but they are people, rather, who rejoice in the salvation of God. And that idea of the word salvation must be understood as broadly as possible here in verse 4. Salvation from enemies, salvation from trials, salvation from sin, salvation from death. All the different aspects of God's salvation for his people are incorporated into that idea of salvation here in verse 4. Let those who love your salvation. So, now let's look at what he asks for these people. He asks first that they be able to rejoice and be glad in God. They have needs, like David does. Maybe not desperate needs, as he has at this moment. But anyway, they have needs and are seeking God for the satisfaction of those needs. And David is saying, let them rejoice and be glad in you. That is, in these present circumstances in which they find need and in which they are seeking you, give them joy. Give them gladness. Now, let them understand, even now in these present circumstances, your mercy and your favor and your goodness towards them, so that they may, even in that present trouble, rise above it, understanding that God is still their God and is still helping them. James says, count it all joy when you fall into various trials. But he also says, let them add to their joy praise. Let those who love your salvation say continually, let God be magnified. These are not then, again, people who say, aha, aha, over oppressed souls. These are people who say, let God be magnified. They not only have joy in trial, but their joy leads them to the praise of God in those trials. And both of these phrases, these requests, also look not only to present circumstances, but to the future, when their joy will be full and their praise of God will be complete. Remember what David says also in Psalm 16, the last verse, you will show me the path of life. In your presence is fullness of joy. At your right hand are pleasures forevermore. Now I think, people of God, that as we look at that petition for the righteous in this verse, we should be struck by something very significant in that petition. And that is that even in his very desperate trouble, David lacks self-centeredness. He's not so caught up with himself and with his own concerns that he cannot think of others. He thinks about others who are also seeking God. And he says, let them have joy and gladness. Not only does he think about others, but he thinks about God. And he doesn't think about God as just one who is there for his help, But he thinks about God as one who is to be praised. That help that comes reflects back to him in the words, "Let God be magnified." There is an entire lack of self-centeredness here. And that's very important for ourselves, for our own instruction, that we understand that when we are in trouble, even when we are in desperate trouble and crying to God to make haste to us, we should not act as if we are the center of the universe and all others and even God himself exist just for our help, just for whatever assistance they may give us. The greatest of God's saints throughout the ages, Old and New Testament alike, have even in their most desperate troubles had these concerns for those who suffer with them, and also for the glory of God. That brings us then to the final request in verse 5, which is really a repetition of the first request. But notice here that David first describes his spiritual state. "I am poor and needy." Those words, "poor and needy," sometimes do describe physical poverty in the Old Testament. But they are also words that have a larger, broader dimension. We can look, for example, at 2 Samuel 22, verse 28. 2 Samuel 22, verse 28. Again, words of David, "You will save the humble." That's poor. "You will save the poor people, but your eyes are on the haughty, that you may bring them down." Obviously, poor stands in contrast with haughty in that verse. And again, in Psalm 34, verse 6, "This poor man cried out, and the Lord heard him and saved him out of all his troubles." Here, the poor man then is one who is suffering many troubles. David's not using these terms then to describe a physical poverty. He's using it to describe his spiritual state, that state of affliction in which he finds himself. And it's because of that great state of affliction, that spiritual poverty in which he finds himself, that he prays, "Make haste to me, O God." But notice in the second part of this verse that he describes God. The first statement of fact, he describes himself. In the second statement, he describes God. "You are my help and deliverer." He has no other help. He has no man who's able to give him the help he needs. He may have for a time relied upon his own resources to deliver him from his trouble, but if he did, he certainly found those resources inadequate by this point. God is his help and deliverer, his one and only help and deliverer, and therefore do not tarry. That's the beginning, people of God, of comfort. To know where we must look and to begin to ask it of his hand. But notice finally about this psalm, people of God, that there is no resolution. The psalm ends where it began. It's not like many, many other psalms where David or the other psalmists complain and make petition, urgent petition to God, and then in the last part of the psalm we find them turning to praise. The psalm ends with petition. David is at the end of this psalm still waiting for God to answer him. Still crying to him, "Make haste, do not delay." What can we learn then? Well, first of all, of course, we see David here praying in desperate circumstances. And we pray to God in desperate circumstances too. But of course, we should not wait for the sense of desperation that we sense here in David before we begin to pray to God. We should always be bringing our needs to Him. Make your requests known to God. In the second place, we should learn, people of God, that we can make the kind of strong petitions that David makes here in this psalm and in other psalms. We can be insistent in this way and persistent in this way. I think we have a sense that it's kind of inappropriate for us as poor and weak creatures, as creatures of the dust, and as sinners as well, to do anything but come to God with very timid and even perhaps tentative petitions, as if He might justly refuse us. And certainly, in a sense, that's true. He could justly refuse us. We think of it as inconsistent with the fear of God that we ought to have, to be bold and persistent and insistent in our prayers. But the scriptures are full of examples and teaching that tells us otherwise. We don't need to be timid. We don't need to be so overwhelmed by the fear of God that we hardly dare to enter His presence. He has spoken promises, great promises. And He expects us to come to Him relying on those promises and reminding Him of those promises and calling upon Him to fulfill His word, to be true to what He has said. Think of Jacob wrestling with the angel at Peniel. I won't let you go until you bless me. Or think of Jesus' words to His disciples in the parable of the importunate woman who would not leave the judge alone until He had done what she asked. And He says to His disciples, if that wicked judge finally did what she asked, will not your heavenly Father do for you what you ask? Ask! Ask again! Ask again! Ask and seek and knock until you have obtained. Be urgent. Be insistent. Seek the fulfillment of the promises of God. Thirdly, we should not be consumed with ourselves, even in our most desperate straits. That's a very great danger, I think, for all of us, that when trouble comes, we get so wrapped up in that trouble that we can think of nothing else and no one else, except insofar as others can be of assistance to us. It's bad. It's indication itself of a very spiritually unhealthy condition when we are so wrapped up in ourselves. We should be thinking of others. We should make ourselves, even in our worst troubles, think of others. And we should, of course, certainly be lifting our eyes above this earth and all its concerns to the God who has become our God. We should be giving Him praise for what He has done. And fourthly, people of God, I think we see in this psalm that much of life is waiting. Waiting for God. We ask, and He does not give. We ask again, and still He withholds His answer. We ask and we seek and we knock, And we go on asking and seeking and knocking, and it seems that God does not hear. The temptation is sometimes to draw the conclusion, he doesn't care. Prayer is useless. Maybe he is a living God, but he's not concerned about me. Much of life is like that, isn't it? We ask, and it seems that God is deaf. The answer of the scriptures to that is persist. Keep on asking. If you are asking what is right and good, keep on asking. Remind God of his promises. He has spoken. He has told you that he is faithful to his word. Expect him then to fulfill that word, whatever it may be. And keep on asking. May God bless the proclamation of his word.